Hello everyone, welcome to Computer Science 75 Section 8. So it's labeled as security, but we're really only going to go over security for just a little portion of this section. So today in section we'll do security, we'll do a little bit more Google Maps stuff, and basically the remainder will just be up to you, any questions that you have, anything that you want to see again or go over. So it could be a relatively short section, or it could be relatively long. So a couple of reminders first is that pre-proposals were due, and you should have already submitted them to your TF, and you should expect replies from your TF by tomorrow evening, because the proposal itself is due next Monday, or this coming Monday. So use the comments or the go-ahead or what have you to work on your proposal from there. Certainly, if you have any questions about that, feel free to ask or ask your TA. So, let's see. Okay, so as with every week, we have some section notes up, and you can find them on the section portion of the website. So, first we'll talk a bit about security. What are, from lecture, what are some of the obvious threats to your script or to your site? What's that? Okay, but even more basic than forms and that sort of stuff. What could happen? What would be a poorly configured server? What kind of services would that be running?
One that has inappropriate access to PHP files.
Okay, good. So inappropriate access to PHP files. Many servers, of course, being servers, run a number of services on them, including FTP and SSH and various other forms of communication or transport of files and data to and from a client to a server. And if many of these services are not secure, not encrypted, then you can run into problems there. So just regular FTP, for example, you generally don't want to have a server that's running on just regular old FTP, and why not? It's all kind of kid stuff, but it's important. So why would we not want FTP running on our server?
Because transfers, passwords and transfers are not encrypted on the wire.
Right, exactly. So, right, passwords, usernames, any files that are transferred are unencrypted, and therefore anybody between you and the server can potentially read the data that's being sent. So as a result, you want to use what service instead?
SFTP.
Yep, SFTP. So similarly, there's Telnet. Telnet's kind of gone the wayside now for SSH, and that's because Telnet is the unencrypted version of SSH. Of course, HTTP, so most of the transactions that we do whenever you visit an HTTP site are not encrypted, but that's usually, for the most part, okay, just because the data isn't necessarily anything that needs to be encrypted. For example, all this data, there's really no reason to do it. And certainly whenever we encrypt data coming from a website, the server takes just, I mean, it may be thousandths or less of a second, but it takes a little bit extra time for the server to encrypt the data. Then it takes a little bit of time for your computer to decrypt the data whenever you're running an HTTPS server. And so this is certainly something else that you have to be mindful of. And certainly one of the things that you'll probably notice, or that you probably have noticed about E75's website, is if you log in, it actually transfers you to a secure site. It says HTTPS up there, just for the transmission of the username and your password. After you've been logged in, it basically bumps you back into just a non-secured HTTP version. And the reason that this is okay is because we're transferring the important data, the username and password, encrypted to the server, and therefore it cannot be read in the clear. But after that, the rest doesn't really matter all that much, so we can send it unencrypted. Any questions about that stuff? Okay, so what are some of the, I mean, some of the technologies that we've been using are PHP, MySQL, JavaScript. Now, JavaScript being client-side means pretty much anything that happens there will happen on the client's computer. And that's, I mean, that can be a bad thing in and of itself, although there are of course, security policies for JavaScript so that it can't, for example, erase all the files on the computer. But some of the other stuff like PHP and MySQL, all of these services run on the server where a lot of users' information or a lot of user data can be stored. And so it would be a really bad thing if a hacker was able to hack into one of these services and run, for example, the drop table command or what have you, just because you would then be losing a lot of data in one of these services. And what's that really popular SQL attack that we've been talking about probably since week three or so? Right, SQL injection. What is that? What is a SQL injection attack? Right, so it's a malicious user inputting a SQL statement into a form that gets submitted to the server, and then the server, because of bad code or because they have not properly escaped the string, will actually send that data to the SQL server and can cause havoc. And I mean, you can even consider this form right here as an example. If this form were poorly written, we would be able to basically perform a SQL injection attack on the login form. And what's one of the ways that we can do that? Let's put on our black hats now and try to perform a SQL injection attack on CS75 server. How can we do this?
One, 2, 3, 4, 5, like the example, or 1 equals 1.
Okay, so first we'll just put in any username. So I'll put in Malin. And password, we'll just put whatever, but probably 1, 2, I mean, it doesn't really even matter. You don't even need to put a really long string. You can just put like 1, let's just put A, for example. So you can't see me typing it, but I'll show you what it says in a second. 1 equals 1. Okay, so what I basically typed in was, give me 1 second, into the username field, I type in Malin. To the password field, I typed in A, and then an apostrophe or a closed string, or 1 equals 1. And, oops. Now, the reason that this is dangerous is because this is SQL syntax right here when issuing a SQL statement. So what we're basically telling it, if our script was stupid and was just doing a SQL statement equals, you know, select star where username equals something, username equals username. Here, I'll put it on the next line to make it easier. And password equals password. And issuing this statement, this would be a bad thing because now we are literally putting this string into here, and so now the password suddenly changes. It's just inserted here, and it's, I mean, you guys have seen this a million times, but 1 equals 1. And so now all it's saying is it selects any row where the username matches the username, so we'll have to get this right, but that's probably, may not be too hard to guess based given the fact that David's name is up there. And password is either A or 1 equals 1. Since 1 always equals 1, unless you're in some weird something or other, then you will definitely be able to get into this site. So what's the remedy for this, for SQL injection attack? It's pretty easy.
Run it through a function that escapes characters.
Right. So we run it through... Right, we run it through a function that takes all of these apostrophes or double quotes and escapes them, so it puts a bunch of slashes before them. But what is the name of that function?
MySQL real escape.
MySQL real escape string. Yep. So it's long and it's obnoxious, but you really should be using this for all of your input that is going to be somehow put into an SQL statement. You actually absolutely must do it. It's really essential that you're able to do this. If this is too long for you, you could actually wrap this function into another function. So if you have a configuration file, for example, you could just do function safe, for example, and take in a string and then return my function, my SQL real escape string with an input into that, the string. And then basically all you're doing is just using the same function, but you're making it into a shorter thing. However, you have to realize that this could be dangerous if you get this wrong, or if your configuration file doesn't recognize this, for example. If you're somehow able to get past errors and this MySQL real escape string isn't run, then you might not actually escape the string. So just do be mindful. But I suppose you could make the same error if you typed real R-A-E-L everywhere rather than E-A-L. But I suppose in the end, having fewer characters to type might be good, just so that, because I mean, frankly, you're going to mess up typing that every so often if you have to keep typing it and typing it. Okay, any questions about that stuff so far? So some of the other things that we talked about were, so what MySQL escape string does is it literally just escapes out all of these extra apostrophes, and so these become literal apostrophes and are tested against the actual password rather than becoming apostrophes used in the SQL statement, just to be clear. So we talked about something called cross-site scripting, and what is cross-site scripting?
That is when an attacker can add some JavaScript code to a good site that sends information from your session to a bad site.
That's right. So cross-site scripting is basically what happens when a malicious user somehow sends JavaScript to the server, which is then outputted onto the page, either by an echo or what have you. And as a result, the browser automatically executes that JavaScript. And then it could, potentially one example would be to forward the cookies from that user's session over to some malicious website. And so confusingly, cross-site scripting realized that we could condense that acronym to CSS, which would make things really hellish for us. But luckily, it's not. It's XSS. So if you ever see XSS, you don't have to get it confused with CSS. So remember that David used the example, if you had this URL, it's really long. You had http://vulnerable.com, and then you pass to it a variable named foo, and the value of which is a script with a document location, and we keep going and going. So let's actually break this down. So realize that we have basically a name value pair here that's being sent to this vulnerable site. It could be even your own site, for example, if it's not properly escaped. So we have this variable, which we don't really care about right now. So let's just take a look at this JavaScript. So this JavaScript, just make an assumption that is going to be sent, or it's going to be outputted into the browser window. So it's saying document.location is going to make it this. And I'll put this on the next line. Okay, so what this says is between script tags we have document location, and then it has a URL to a different domain here, and it sends it to a PHP file, and specifically the data that's being sent to that PHP file is the document's cookie, or the cookie that exists for this particular website. So this isn't the cookie for badguy.com, this is the cookie for vulnerable.com, because it's vulnerable.com that is executing, or it's not that the domain, not the server that it's executing the script, but you are viewing this web page from vulnerable.com and your browser is executing this script. Document.location is literally just the URL of the current open browser window, and this should be pretty obvious as well, the document.cookie. So You have to be careful, though, that this is actually valid JavaScript, so we might need to put a semicolon here, for example, but then it might actually run. So when would this be dangerous, though? Well, realize that vulnerable.com has to make the mistake of actually outputting this variable into the body. So let's see. Just by doing, for example, an echo, let's see, was it get foo. So if vulnerable.com had an index.php file, and in it, it somewhere just had a straight out echoing out of a foo, then you would be vulnerable to this sort of attack. Now, this is something that, I mean, we've talked about and we've encouraged people to do early on. We were saying, just echo out the variable because you don't have to really worry about it. Well, now you have to go back and actually pay attention to whenever you echo out a variable, because now it's not, even though this looks somewhat safe, it's not actually safe anymore, especially if your website deals with cookies or cookies that are important at all. So certainly for any website that deals with logins or any sort of user-sensitive data, you absolutely must make sure that you are not vulnerable to XSS, cross-site scripting. So what can we do to fix this problem? It is, yes.
So instead of echoing get foo, you could say, I don't know if you're saying this would work or not, but foo equals strip tags.
Right, so that's so strip tags. So, right, so we were talking about this before section, and I was not sure if it would be, if it's a comprehensive solution to the problem, just because I wasn't able to think through the implications of it. But just so you know, let's take a look at the PHP documentation for strip tags. So this is a pretty handy function, and what it does is, it says that it strips HTML and PHP tags from a string. Now remember, though, that what we were passing in was JavaScript, but why might this be useful in sanitizing the JavaScript?
Because you're taking out the open and close strip elements.
Right, we're taking out the open and close script elements. So the problem, like we were discussing before class, was that if for some stupid reason you were echoing out the result directly into JavaScript code, then you might get this sort of problem. But for the most part, I'm sure if you're just outputting it straight into the document, then this might actually be a pretty good solution. I certainly can't think of a solution, unless you're putting it into JavaScript tags, I don't see why this would fail as a solution for this problem. Okay. Any questions so far? All right, so if you take a look at the Wikipedia entry on cross-site scripting, there's actually a number of what they claim to be good or famous examples of cross-site scripting attacks, but frankly, I don't believe it because I haven't really heard of many or any of them. Let's see if this brings up the right thing. Okay, so XSS, cross-site scripting. So you should take a look at these if you want, and on your leisure time, just to scare yourself into making sure that you sanitize all of your input. Oh boy. Oh, here it is. Okay. So real-world examples, they say. So besides the real-world examples of all of your code that's potentially vulnerable to cross-site scripting, they actually have examples of real businesses or real websites that have been vulnerable to this, and it's a bit of a good read, even though, like, for example, this one, like Bugzilla, like, if you use Firefox, you may know what Bugzilla is, but that's not that interesting, and so on and so forth. Okay.
MySpace one, I definitely remember hearing about when it happened.
Right, yeah, there was a MySpace one that happened, man, when was that? They have...
There's a reference to one in 2005.
Right, so here it is. On October 13th, 2005, they exploited a security flaw in MySpace, resulting in and over 1 million friend requests being made to its creator's profile, which is an interesting thing. I remember hearing about that, but I don't remember much about it other than that, because personally I don't like MySpace. Yes?
Because the browser doesn't prevent this, there are lots of good reasons why, while you're in page A, I mean, you could have just clicked the link to go to page B in another domain. I mean, the browser doesn't prevent you from the second request from being executed, because there's lots of good reasons that requests from one domain may access, then it doesn't know what
right.
you're doing.
So the
browser does prevent you, if you have frames or whatever, from crossing from one frame to another. Where,
right.
Because that's considered dangerous, because the frames could have been put up by two different sites, and that means that, you know, JavaScript in your site is reading the code of another site.
Right, no, so, certainly. Yeah, no, this is, I mean, these are, it's kind of an unfortunate result of useful technologies that exist, like this document. .location is a useful JavaScript element for us to use. Where was it? Oh, did I already move it? And it's an unfortunate side effect that just by, I mean, it's just a combination of all of these things coming together. Your ability to output an input directly into your page, and a web browser's ability to directly parse JavaScript live as soon as the page has been loaded, and then the JavaScript's document.location. It's just, I mean, it's an unfortunate side effect of all of these things, but each of these things separately are all useful to us. But so that's why we don't really want to get rid of this by disabling one or more of these features, because certainly echoing out this stuff is very useful to us. Document.locations and document.cookie, even if not immediately obvious why it's useful, is certainly useful in some contexts. So it's better to just be careful. And this is why we're always telling you to sanitize all the inputs from the client. Don't trust anything that ever comes from a client-side browser. So there was another type of security vulnerability that we were talking about, cross-site request forgery, or let's see, there's two acronyms for this, CSRF and XSRF, so you can call it CSRF or XSRF or whatever. And again, Wikipedia has pretty interesting documentation on this, but what is the CSRF or XSRF vulnerability? We've got an hour and a half to stand up here and wait for you guys to answer. So.
You visit your bank site in your browser.
Yep.
And then you don't log out, and you go and visit the bad guy's site. The bad guy's site includes a URL that makes your bank, that makes your account on the bank site do something, like say transfer money.
Right.
And if that action can be expressed in the form of a, you know, well, actually, anything. I mean, a get or a post, then it will happen because your session at the bank site is still active.
Right. So that's very good. Right. So let's take the example of your Project 2s or the CS75 Finance. Let's say that I'm sure many of your sites are actually vulnerable to this type of vulnerability, but let's say that as a TF, I log into the site to test it. Now I go to someone else's site, just, you know, whoever. It can be somebody else on a completely different domain. Now they happen to know the URL of your project. So project2.domain.tld. They also happen to know that buy.php is the script that buys stocks of whatever. Then what they can do is exploit the fact that you still have a valid cookie at project2.domain.tld and just create a link to that buy.php and just have you inadvertently buy stocks in whatever stock they want you to do. So if your projects were live and you were actually buying stocks, this could be a very dangerous thing, because now we would have lots of stocks being bought and sold when we didn't want them to be. And so this is not... it's not as easy, perhaps, as the XSS to solve. I mean, here we were able to just come up with the strip tags and, you know, for the most part, probably repair this problem on a cross-site scripting vulnerability. What about a CSERF vulnerability like this? What do we have to do?
You have to do some kind of verification for each transaction.
Right. No, that's, yeah, so, and I certainly wish this would happen more in real life, too, is that each transaction is verified rather than, you know, you are authorized and then everything within that is allowed. So Amazon.com was a good example used from lecture where you can add stuff to your cart and you can just add as many things as you want without needing to verify your identity. But as soon as you want to purchase something, as soon as you want to actually cause the or create a transaction, then you have to log in. Then you would send your username and password, because then that way, for example, buy.php in this example that we were just talking about, if you were to verify the login information first, you would realize that there's something amiss if you click on a link and you're brought again to the login page for your project. Yes?
Maybe I forget, just forget what David said about this on Monday, but how can they do this with Post, if you're using Post, if the action has to be encoded in the URL that they're using?
It doesn't have to be encoded in the URL.
Right, that's
right.
You
can use JavaScript to perform a post to the bank site or the finance site.
Right, so just for the camera, I'll repeat. So when you're... This works very easily for GET queries because the GET query can be encoded in the URL itself. However, many of you may have used POST only. I don't have the HTTP headers tool. But with JavaScript, it's pretty easy to just send POST data to a website. So you can fake POST data as well to a particular website and still cause a CSERF vulnerability to happen. So even though you're using POST versus GET, you still should not and cannot trust the transaction or any of the data coming in from the client. So you must verify whenever possible.
So I think maybe an effective defense for, you know, when I'm designing my finance app would be for any transaction to require information that is not contained in the cookie and is not contained in the URL, such as, it could be contained in the URL. Let's say, like, the user's username. The bad guy site could not craft a URL that contains my username. Therefore, the submission to the finance site would fail.
Why couldn't they do that?
Because how would they know my username?
It's probably easier, yes.
They could fail.
Well, they have your session ID.
If it was or some piece of information that is either contained in that is created on the fly in the URL that the bank site page that you're currently looking at, or have it contained within the web form on the valid site that username is sort of like that's something that is potentially guessable, but you'd have to be targeting a particular person to guess it, but you can make it harder by containing like a random string.
Let me see if I understand. So you're saying that one of the ways potentially to resolve these issues is to encode in the URL itself either the username or some random string that only the client and the server know, so that a malicious site could not form the URL properly because it wouldn't know that string.
Right. The client wouldn't have to know the string per se. It would have to be a string that is only contained within a URL constructed by the valid site.
So I think that's still risky because it's possible to perform both an XSS and a CSERF at the same time. And so if you were to, for example, if a malicious user were to first, this requires two failure points in your website, but still, if you have two failure points, we'll skip the ramifications of that. But if they're able to obtain the cookie for your session, then they would also potentially be able to figure out the request URI or the requested URL and maybe be able to, they would have to know the setup of your URL. But if this is a bank, And people are looking at the URL every day, a malicious user would be able to go through the URL and figure, okay, well, this string is just some random string associated with my session that is sent back and forth to authenticate me as a user. So I think that it's still risky, because in that case, I think you're just obfuscating data, which makes it a little bit harder, but it's still possible for them to attack for if a malicious user really wanted to.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm not... Yeah, I mean, if your banking site or if the banking site or the shopping site has a cross-site scripting vulnerability, then that's the more serious vulnerability, right? I mean,
depends on your point of view, I guess. I think it's pretty serious if someone maxes out my credit card with a CSERF vulnerability on Amazon.com. But
no, yeah, no, absolutely, but.
Yeah, I understand what you mean, I think, but I think it's a risky step, because I still think that you're still trusting the clients by sending data to them. Even if the malicious user doesn't see it immediately, it's still being sent over the wire to the client. So I think that it may still be, that's why I said it's just obfuscated data now rather than being truly secure. So I think it's maybe marginally more secure, or maybe two or three steps even more secure, but it's still not rock solid, so to speak. I'm sorry. Yeah. David.
What about requiring that the MAC address be the same for all of the communications within a login session?
The MAC address. So the server wouldn't know the MAC address of the requesting client. But it's also possible that the MAC address would change if, for example, someone switched at their home router from a wired to a wireless connection, for example. So
it would be okay for them to be forced to log out and log back in.
Right. Well, it's a moot point, because the MAC address still is not accessible by only the IP addresses. I believe that's the lowest level that's accessible to the browser.
This obviously won't work either, because it's easy. When you're logged in and you leave the bank site to some other place, there's nothing that the bank site server knows that you left. But when you return, there's a referrer address of where the previous page was.
Right.
Is it safer to say if the referrer address was me? Don't be as secure than if he visited. You can't prevent him from visiting somewhere else and coming back.
Right.
But can he spoof the referrer address?
So you're saying to use the referrer address to try to determine if the preceding page was from the same domain or a different domain. That would be good in theory. However, the referrer address can be spoofed. So you shouldn't trust that either.
And it's even optional, and there's proxies that strip it off. So
right, it can be stripped off.
You can interfere with legitimate people's activity.
That's
and all
right.
Of the traffic can be spoofed. You can open up a telnet session and send headers and stuff that look like what a browser would send.
You can spoof all of the traffic if you are a quick enough typist, yes, with a telnet connection, yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of suggestions that were made in lecture, so... using POST, as we discussed, is bad because it's easily spoofed. HTTP referrer, append session tokens to URLs, like you suggested, that's another one, but can be failed. CAPTCHAs are extremely annoying, and I got to say that I would much rather type in my password again than try to decipher a stupid CAPTCHA. Those seem to be failing left and right anyway. So you could also expire sessions quickly. But that would require to re-log in, re-authenticate anyway. So, I mean, there's no truly excellent good solution, because ideally it would just know the user, but unfortunately at this point it seems, at least in my opinion, that the best option would be to just re-authenticate the user for very important transactions, for example, a buy or a sell or what have you, along those lines. Just browsing, perhaps not so important, for example, in... Going back to project 2, just getting a stock quote, that's probably not so important to get to authenticate the user, unless you were price fixing and making them more expensive for some people than others, but that's a whole different thing. Any questions? Okay. So Google Maps. So talk a little bit more about Google Maps. So if you remember from, let's see, was it? Yeah, it must have been last week. I showed you this code that basically just centered the map on Harvard Hall, and it put a marker there. And then when you clicked on the marker, it brought up a info window. So there's a slight tweak to this code that I want to make, though, and that is that you notice that this info window points at the exact same place as the marker. And frankly, this has been annoying me for the past couple of weeks because we've been talking about how to do it from this way rather than the Google Maps way, which shows the info window starting from just above the marker. So if you take a look at the Google Maps API reference, you'll notice that under GMap2, let me make this bigger. Is it actually bigger? Okay. Oh, great. Too big. Let's see. So we had... Oops. We had the method open info window up in the GMap class. Let's see, that is somewhere. Looking for it. Ugh, okay. Right, well, it's here somewhere. Why can I not find this now? Oh, okay. Here it is. So this is a method of the GMaps2 class to open an info window given a latitude and longitude. Now, let's take a look, though. If you go to gmarker, there is also a ginfo window or an open info window here. Now, you realize that this is the same method, it's just within a different class, and it requires a different number of arguments. And in this case, it doesn't require the latitude and longitude. So I want to show you how we can modify this code, even though it's really quite simple. We can modify this code here to be able to show the info window properly over the marker rather than over the or at the same point as the marker. So we have here a creation of a marker by creating and instantiating a new GMarker class at the Harvard points, which, remember, is just a Harvard is just a variable containing a glatlong point showing the proper latitude and longitude coordinates of Harvard Hall. Then we add an overlay of the marker, which shows the marker on the map itself. And now what we did was we added a listener to this marker using the gEvent class. Ugh, why can't I? Just going to move this up a little bit, make it easier to see. So we added a listener that listens at the marker for a click. When it does, it basically just puts in the link to the course website and opens an info window on the map. But remember that GMarker also has an open info window, so instead of it being map, I will just use my marker or the marker that I have here. And remember that it's a different set of arguments where we do not need the latitude and longitude coordinates anymore, just the info that goes in the info window itself. So I'll save it. It should be uploaded. And we will try this again. So we'll reload. All right, so we have a marker. We click on the marker. And now you see that the info window starts at the top of the marker, which is much more Google Maps-like rather than at the bottom. It's a small thing, but it was something that, if it annoyed me, I'm sure it was annoying maybe one or two other people as well. Okay. Any questions about markers or overlays or that modification specifically? Okay. So we can actually clear markers as well, and we just hand waved last week and said that it was possible to do, but we didn't talk about how it's possible to do it. So we'll make another modification to this code where whenever the map is moved, we will just clear all the markers. So this is probably a bad idea in practice, because you'll first want to determine if the marker is still within or outside of the bounds that are shown, but it's just going to be a very basic, simple example. So rather than doing all this stuff, I'll comment this out because I don't really care about this stuff anymore. This was the old code that detected when the marker had moved out of bounds, and when it did, it said that you must be a distant student. And what we will do is make it remove the marker. Anybody know how to do that?
Question.
Yeah.
When you do the at listener, it says map move in. If you're removing markers, do you have that? Would it be marker move in or map move
in? If you're removing markers, does it have to be map or marker? So in this case, it's the map that's being moved, because this event move end is happening on the map or the gmap class. So you can add a listener for any of the events that occur to a particular class, but move end is an event. I'll scroll up a little bit to show you. It's an event, so it's under the events portion of the Google map, of the gmap2 class, which means that our gmap2 variable must be the one that's being move ended, so to speak. Does that make sense? So if there were a move end for marker, then you would be able to listen for that event, but it doesn't make sense that there would be, because it's the map that's being moved and not the marker itself. Okay. Right.
I'll take a wild guess. How about remove overlay?
Ha, good. Okay, so remove overlay. So that's very close. It's actually clear overlays, but that gets rid of all of them. So map.clearOverlays will clear all of the overlaid objects on the map. And so in this case, I only have one overlaid object, which is the marker, and it will clear that. But just to prove to you that it works, I'll save this, go back to the site, refresh. Okay, and you'll see that as soon as I move the map, now that marker has been cleared. So how can I clear all of the overlays only if... No, okay. Let's make a modification. How can I clear an overlay... let's see. How can I just clear one overlay rather than all of them?
Any ideas how to measure that? Which one you want to clear.
Right. So, yeah, you need to know which one you want to... You would need... which one you would want to clear, and most likely... That would be something perhaps in the G marker. So let's see. We can take a look in the methods. We can just take a wild guess and see if it's possible to do from here. So far, it's not. So there's a hide function, which doesn't realize this isn't actually clearing memory. We will just be able to hide it. So this is saying that I would be able to use gmarker.hide to actually hide a particular marker. So we'll try that next, see if this works. So instead of map.clearOverlays, we'll do mymarker.hide. Okay, so we'll save it. We'll refresh this page. It should recenter on Harvard Hall with the marker. Now as soon as I move it, it hides the marker. So realize that we haven't actually destroyed this marker in memory. It's still there. It's just hidden. So we could actually do some fancy JavaScripting, and every time we move it, we could hide it and then reshow it and then hide it, which would drive a user nuts, but that would be something that we could do. But now that we've figured out a way of just making it disappear, how can we hide the marker only if it's off the map?
Test it against the bounds.
Right, so we would test it against the bounds. So after the map has been moved, what we'll do is we'll check if the latitude and longitude of the point of the marker exists within the latitude and longitudinal bounds of the map that's showing. And so we can actually then just reuse some of the old code from last week, where we defined the variable this window to be the bounds of the map. So variable this window equals map.getBounds. And then we are able to test if this window does not, because there's an exclamation point here, does not contain the latitude and longitude of myMarker.getLatLong, whereas before we were displaying an alert, this time we can just hide the marker altogether. So this is good. Let's give this a shot. And moving it off the screen, and you see that it disappeared at the very bottom there. Now, if we were to move it back into the screen, is it going to show up again? What do you think? Nope, it's not going to, because it's still hidden. We could add some additional code that said if it's within the bounds, then we can show the marker again, but that's kind of redundant at this point.
Well, we still haven't gotten rid of an individual marker. We've only hidden it.
Right, we haven't gotten rid of an individual marker. We've only hidden it. That's right.
Can we get rid of an individual marker?
We should be able to get rid of an individual marker. Does anybody know how?
Destroy.
Destroy? Is that a method in...
No, I don't.
Let's see. I know it's possible, but I think what we'll do is...
remove overlay.
Ooh, remove overlay. How about that? Okay. So just by scrolling in the API, I've answered my own question here. So let's take a look at what remove overlay does. Remove overlay. Nope. All right, so this says this is part of the GMAP2 class, and it's remove overlay. Removes the overlay from the map. If the overlay was on the map, it fires the remove overlay event. So it's not clear if this object would be destroyed afterwards. It sounds like it may not be. It's just that the overlay will no longer be on the map. So instead of doing hide, we can do map.removeOverlay and insert my marker. So you see what I've done here is, because my marker is in overlay, I'm just using map.removeOverlay and referring the my marker to it. So I'll save that and give this a refresh. See, so it should behave the same way that it just did just a minute ago. So move it down. You'll see that it was removed off of the map. So now rather than being hidden, we can assume that it's actually gone. But it's not clear if the object itself has been destroyed. Let's see. If you are using an array of markers, it's probably not going to matter too much, because you could reuse old indices rather than trashing them, or trashing a set of variables and then recreating them. Okay, any questions? Yep?
Could you go back to the code that you had there, where it said, you can go over to the right, but you just put that set after contain flat.
So after, so wait, what are you asking
about?
Yeah,
just about? get let blank.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so it says, if not this window dot contains lat long, and then in parentheses it's my marker dot get lat long, and dot get lat long is a method for the marker class, the gmarker class, that provides a point, latitude and longitude point, and this window is a bounds, it's g lat long bounds class, which has a method contains lat long, which tests if a point that's passed into it is contained within the bounds of that particular boundary. So that's all that's it does. If you were to just kind of read it out loud, it kind of does what it sounds like. Okay, let's take a 5-minute break. Welcome back, everybody. Okay, so last week, Chris Power, one of the TFs here, actually wrote a really good example on a mashup, and I just wanted to go over that here in case some of you haven't seen it. So you can access it, of course, via the the sections part of the course's webpage. So you go to section 7 and course, and what we are interested in here is Google 3 weather. All the rest are we're very familiar with. So in this case, it's just a pretty typical GMAP2 instantiation, but the great thing is that you type in a zip code and you hit go, and it shows you basically the weather for that particular zip code. So how does this work? Any ideas? I guess those of you who might have seen it before would know, but not you. How might this work? Yes?
It's basically take the zip code, they take the location, send it to the weather site, get the XML, and then present it to the market.
That's right, yep. So it's retrieving the zip code from the text input here, and it's sending it using some AJAX call, most likely to, I believe it's Yahoo Weather. I forget now. I've seen a number of them. But it's being returned from a particular weather website in XML, which I believe is being created into a JSON file. So let's take a look at the code here and see what it looks like. So first off, one strange thing is that Chris is using a jQuery script here. And so I just want to show you really very, very briefly a little bit about jQuery. It's a library much like YUI or any of these others that you have seen. And it basically allows you to simplify a number of tasks, including AJAX calls or even a number of animations or various other things. You can access it by just going to jQuery.com. But one of the strange things about the syntax is that jQuery is instantiated and is accessed with a dollar sign. So rather than it being sort of a typical name like jQuery or what have you, they actually use a dollar sign. And you can that's not only a function where you can pass in variables, but it's also an object that has a number of methods and properties associated with it. Of course, they have a fairly rigorous documentation that goes over a number of things that are pretty interesting, and it's certainly something to take a look at in more detail if you have the interest. So, okay, now that we have that out of the way, so we have, of course, the script elements that links to the Google Maps, and all of this stuff looks pretty standard so far. So one of the things that you didn't see in the scripts that I was using before was creating the variables as global variables before defining any of the functions. And this might actually be very useful for you to do, whereas I created the map variable in the initialize function because everything was happening in the initialize function. As your script grows, you may actually be using the map or the Google Map instantiation in other functions other than the initialized one. So you might want to put a lot of these variables, define them as global variables first, and then just insert them as, or just insert null values into them. Did you have a question? Oh, okay. Okay. So we see that, before I move on, we see that we have one for map, for a geocoder, and for a current point, which will be pretty useful in just a minute. So let's go down a bit. Okay, so this is the initialize function, which should look very familiar. It's very much like all of the other initialize functions that we've had. First thing we do is instantiate the map, and then we're just creating a point, just as it's called central square, and the latitude and longitude coordinates are probably approximate or are fairly good. Then we're setting the set center. Remember that the set center method must be the first method that you apply to the Google Map class before anything else. So just to reduce confusion, I put this directly after, but since we're not actually modifying the map class at all, this line of code right here is okay. So this is all familiar stuff. In this case, Chris added a control that I kind of glossed over before, and this was just adding a control for a large map control, and that just shows, if you remember, let's see. Oops. Is this it? No, that's not it. Oh, here it is. It just shows basically the zoom and the navigation controls on the map itself. All right, so you can also enable the scroll wheel zoom with the enable scroll wheel zoom method. You can find all this stuff in the API. And then we want to initialize or to instantiate a gclient geocoder class, because what we will do with this is add the ability to search for particular objects or zip codes. So we'll just realize or remember that geocoder was one of the global variables that we defined. So now that we have defined or instantiated the gclient geocoder class into geocoder, all of our successive functions will now be able to access this same class. This is just a nice thing where he adds the focus of the document onto the zip code input. Any questions about this stuff? We've seen this multiple times, so I don't mean to bore you, but do let me know if you have questions. Okay, moving on. Before we move on to this stuff, we should probably take a look at the HTML itself. So, of course, at the body onload, we run the initialize function. On unload, we run the gunload function to destroy any data, so we don't have any sort of leaks or anything like that. And we have a division for the map down here. And we have a couple of inputs, the submit button and an address field as an input where we typed in the zip code. So remember the name, address, that will be important later. So one other important thing to notice here is that the form element has an onSubmit attribute. And there, it's just like we've done 1.5 million times before. We are running a JavaScript function, and afterwards we are returning false so that the function does not, or so that the form does not get submitted. So I've seen a couple of questions on this where people say that they have done return false, but it's still submitting the form anyway. That means that you have some error in your code, in the function right here, that's causing JavaScript to fail. And so since return false is the very last thing that happens, if it doesn't reach this return false function, then it's still going to submit the form. So this can cause some headaches. So if it's submitting the form and you know you have a return false at the end, check to make sure that you don't have any errors in your function. I think Firebug also has the nasty habit of showing you an error, but then erasing it when the form is submitted because it's reloading the page. So it looks like an error is flashing very quickly. So that's one of the symptoms of this problem. And unfortunately, it makes life difficult. OK, so you saw that up there we had, we were calling the function called go and sending it the value of the address field, right? It was the form.address.value. And that's exactly what's happening here. So first we make sure that the geocoder class has been instantiated, which it should be, but it's just good to make sure. Better would be to have a message of some kind if it actually failed and say that it wasn't instantiated for some reason. And then we use the getLatLong method of the geocoder, of the gclient geocoder class, which when we pass it the address or the value that was in the input, basically it sends an AJAX request to Google servers. They do all the difficult processing to try to find the location or what have you, and it returns a point, a latitude and longitude point, which you use a function to process. So the very next thing after you submit the address is basically the function or the lambda function that gets called when that data has been returned. And you see that one of, or the argument of this function is a point. It's just named point. You can, being just a variable, you can name it anything you want. If point ends up being null or being false, then you get the address was not found. So you either typed it in wrong or what have you. But this that's certainly a good way. This makes it much easier because now you don't have to do all of the processing for addresses and zip codes or what have you. Google will be able to do a lot of that for you. If this is true, if we do have a point, then this else statement runs, which it almost always should be for a valid zip code, and we're setting the global variable current point to the point, because remember that this point will not be accessible outside of this lambda function unless we have some larger scope variable, as this current point variable is. And this, remember, this looks confusing at first, but this is that jQuery script. So what we're telling jQuery to do now, there is a getJSON method that calls wonderground-json.php, which is a PHP file in this same folder. We can take a look at that in a minute. So this is the file that it should contact in an AJAX request. And then the next thing you send it is the data. So this is just, this should look familiar. This is just a JSON object, or it's just a JavaScript object, where we have a query that's a point. So it's the latitude, comma, the longitude from that point. Okay? And then so within the curly braces is that object. That's the data that's being sent. And then we have the very end, a callback. So this callback is the function that gets called when we receive data back from that PHP script. Okay, this is all a function of the JSON or the jQuery implementation, which I hope I still have it up. So if we were to look under documentation, it's under AJAX, and you'll see that there are a number of AJAX requests. Let's see, it's not here. We got to scroll down a bit. So there's getJSON right here, jQuery.getJSON. You'll see that it requires URL, and optionally you can send it. Optionally, you can send it some data and a callback function to process that data. There's a bunch of examples and source code on the jQuery website to get you started with this. Back to this, we should probably take a look at the callback function now to see what happens. So this makes sense. So realize that there's a couple of requests going on here. So first, when we hit submit, we type in some address or we type in some zip code, we hit submit, and what happens? It calls the Go JavaScript function, which we've written up here, which sends the data in the address or the value of the address field to Google. When we get a response, it runs this large lambda function that's in here. If the address is found, then what we are doing is setting the current point to that point, because current point is the global variable, and then we're basically sending another request to our own PHP file with the data that's been returned. So now what we want to look at is what happens to the data when that second request is returned. So this callback function. So this callback takes the JSON weather data and creates a marker based on that data, adds it to the map, then centers the map on that point. So first thing it does is, after this request has been made, it clears all the overlays, which we've just seen, removes all of the markers and such. Then it adds a marker at the current point. And remember that this current point is a global variable that represents the return from Google's client, or G client, geocoder. Then we add the new marker to the overlay. Then, of course, we want to create the info window, and that's what is being done here with creating an HTML variable. All of this, you can take a look at the source if you're interested in seeing the actual HTML. But then when the marker is clicked, remember that we have to add a listener so that whenever the marker is clicked, then we can show the open info window HTML. So remember the modification that you know, I recommended was to not use the map, but to use the marker.openinfo window itself, because it just it makes it look more Google Maps style, so if you prefer that way. One of the things you'll notice that's interesting about this code, though, is that, so, well, remember this, keep this in mind, but the next thing that it will do is it will actually change the center of the Google Maps based on the results of that point. So it's going to recenter the map based on the point that was returned from Google. Because remember that when we first loaded up the web page, it was just centered on Central Square. What if I had put a zip code somewhere else, like in California or in Texas, for example? If we don't recenter the map, we're not going to see the marker that has shown up. Okay, so this is actually some pretty fancy code. What this is saying is, so bounds, remember this was the same as that, what was the variable I used? Window, I forget now. I forget what, it was a different variable name, but it does the same thing. So it's saying that if the current point is within the bounds of the visible window, then it's going to do a nice smooth pan to that particular point. So just to show you again, what it looks like. So right here I have 02138, and I'll just do 02141, which is visible. Now you see that it just does a pan over to it. But if I do something completely different, like 79912, it basically, wow, that's wrong. Okay, it's not Las Cruces, it's El Paso, Texas. Okay, anyway, interesting. We'll have to debug that, I guess. But anyway, so you'll see that it's been recentered near I-10. It's okay, never mind. I guess you guys would. Las Cruces is like, what's that?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, no.
Could you get the map to just expand to contain all points?
Can you get the map to expand to all points?
Out, if I had, like, basically zoom out, right?
You know, like, oh, okay.
New York and San Francisco.
Yeah, you can set the zoom level of the map. I don't know offhand if it makes an easy, if there's an easy way for it to automatically set the zoom level given all of the markers that are visible on the map. I suspect that you would have to do some fancy math to figure out, you know, the width or, you know, the change in longitude and the change in latitude between all of these markers and then set the zoom appropriate. I frankly don't know if there's an easy way to do it. You'd have to scour the API to see if there is. But you can set the zoom to show more markers. Certainly can.
There's got to be some way to do it, right? Because isn't that what you're doing with driving directions? The map you end up with shows the beginning and end points?
Yeah, that's true.
That is true, yeah. So the driving directions do show the entire route.
Yeah.
So it must have some way. I don't know offhand. Yeah, I mean, I would just basically do what you guys would do and just look in the API reference to see if there's some easy way to do it. I wonder if that may be a method specific, because I think there's a specific class for directions. But I would assume that something like that seems useful enough that if it's accessible to the directions, it should be accessible to generic data sets as well.
You'd have to have the old location, New York, and the new location, Texas, or whatever, right?
Yeah, you'd have to have both locations in memory somehow. I assume you might send it an array of points or something like that in order to get it to work, but okay. But moving on, so this is interesting that it shows the wrong city. But anyway, so you see the difference there. So now, you don't actually have to open an info window just by clicking on it. You can, of course, open an info window directly, and that's what Chris has done here. So automatically, after you've set the marker on the screen, you've recentered the map, and now you're going to show an info window that shows the HTML from that particular location. But remember that this is basically it for the JavaScript, for that weather mashup. So the next important thing then is the PHP file, which of course is sent the latitude and longitude points of a particular location, and returns the weather based on that location. So w underground dash JSON, we'll look at the PHPS, and you'll see that this is it. It's very, very simple. So it gets the query from the get command, and then it receives from w underground. Let's scroll over a bit. It returns an XML based on the query. So for some reason, I assume it must be some problem with w underground where the latitude and longitude points that make up 79912 or El Paso, Texas, for some reason in their records map is 40 miles away in Las Cruces, New Mexico. So
it seems to be working now.
It's working now?
Yeah. 79912 is now showing El Paso.
Weird.
Or wait, is
it 12 or 79912? Yeah. It's working now. Okay. Well, we'll try it in just a second to verify. But just to finish going over this. So we're just putting into a simple XML object the result of getting that XML file, and then we send just very easily. We have to remember that when sending a JSON object from a PHP file, you have to set the content type correctly to application JSON, and then echo out the encoding of that XML. Really simple to do even this. I mean, relatively, it's a pretty complex mashup when you think about it. Like, you're mixing a lot of data together here, but it only needed, 25 minutes of explanation and just several lines of code. So let's see now how 79912 fares. Click go. And how it shows El Paso, Texas.
So maybe this is like a temporary geocoder glitch, right?
It could be. Well, let's see if there's some. Yeah, it is. It's showing it right near Belvedere. Well, let's see if we can go back to Cambridge. Oh, so interesting. This is off too now, because now it says Boston rather than Cambridge. So there must. I wonder if there's some caching issue going on. Let's try. What's somebody give me a random zip code that they know?
53051.
53051?
Mountain Falls, Wisconsin.
Milwaukee, Timmerman, Wisconsin? Is that right?
That's about 20 miles.
The map is right.
Yeah, the map was right in 79912 as well. But, okay, how about another one? Let's try one more. 90291. Santa Monica? Is that right?
This is actually Venice. But
it's actually Venice, so something seems to be a little bit off.
And that would be the Weather Underground, though.
That's supplying Venice.
No, well, that's the thing, is that it shows the correct map, and that's what it did for 79912, 021 for 1. Yeah. And
it seems to be taking the larger place.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that's weird, because Las Cruces is definitely smaller than El Paso, but... Huh.
But that's that zip code table, right?
It could be that zip code table, yeah. So there could be... Well, this result is from Weather Underground, so it must be some problem with Weather Underground rather than some caching issue.
Well,
El Paso has like 250,000 people, so I know it has a weather station. So I don't know. I mean, I hate to.
Well, in Cambridge.
That's right. It did come up the second time I looked at it. So, interesting. Yeah, that's right.
It matters. What I did was I did 79912, and it showed me the wrong thing. And then I did a search for El Paso, and then I did a search for 79912, and it.
But when I did it here, I just did 79912, and it showed El Paso.
But maybe it cached what I did.
Oh, maybe it cached what you did.
Because I searched for El Paso, so maybe that made it. Maybe searching for El Paso forced it to like look up zip code information related to El Paso or something. I don't know.
That's true. That's weird. I have no idea. I don't know how to answer it.
Is that short PHP program doing anything that you couldn't actually do from the server, from the client? Is that absolutely necessary in this example?
Is it doing anything that you can't... Is the PHP file... Right. So is this PHP file doing anything that we can't do via JavaScript from the client?
If they had an RSS...
I imagine you could probably do it directly as well. I think there may be a problem.
Single domain?
Yeah, I think it's a single domain limitation where you can't do an AJAX request. No, what is it? You can't do some sort of request off the domain that you're currently running.
Which is CS75.net.
Right, which is CS75.net. And
the server can and you can't.
Right, I don't want to misspeak, so I don't know if it's the AJAX request itself, or it's the XML HTTP request object, I think, that cannot do a off browser AJAX request. So, or an off domain.
That's a security restriction.
It is a security restriction, yes. So that's why So that's why you have to
each
do it.
Each one of those steps could be done, but
Technically, you should, in theory, you should be able to do it, but in terms of the security, you cannot. Good question.
Are you getting the latitude and longitude?
So where am I getting? So the
geocoder. From the you're inputting the zip code and then you're getting the latitude.
Right. So. Okay, so where are we getting the latitude and longitude? Let's see, do I still have the... No. So that happens in the HTML file via the JavaScript. So let me make it big again. So there is the gclient geocoder class that we instantiated first thing. And the thing that this class does for us is it takes some input and tries to find its location. And the output is a latitude and longitude. And so when we hit go, when we hit submit, we're running this go function that first determines if the geocoder exists, if the class has been instantiated. Then it runs the geocoder.getLatLong. The getLatLong method sends the address or the input that the user has made, sends the input, and then it returns a point. And that point is a latitude and longitude coordinate. So in order to process that information, you have to have a lambda function that accepts a point right here. So address, comma function with an argument point, and that function itself contains the point, which is the glatlong of type glatlong, which contains the latitude and longitude. So it was that part, and then with this getJSON part from the jQuery class, we were able to send it the point.latitude and the point.longitude. Yes?
Can you scroll slightly to the right function? Okay, over here, they're calling to callback function.
Yes.
And when you go down to the actual callback function, mm-hmm. it's also required an argument.
Right. So
how did jQuery know that this is just the name, and how it knows what to send?
So the documentation in jQuery, I believe, says that if you're going to have a callback function, it should accept a certain set of arguments. It should accept a data argument that's being returned. So that's what we are assuming. We're assuming that what their documentation says is correct, and that the callback function should be allowed to send data to it. Just like if we were to look at the Google Maps API for the getLatLong and the geocoder function, gclient geocoder function class, it would say that we have to have a callback function that, well, we don't have to, but if we want it to be useful, the callback function should accept an argument that accepts a Google LatLong coordinate. So in the same way, the documentation here, we can verify.
What they're saying is that when you're defining it, you should not send to it what you want to send to it.
You
know, when you're calling a function, mm-hmm. you're putting the parentheses and you're putting the variables that you send to the function.
Right.
And the only reason I'm asking, because this, from all the documentation and other examples, this is the only example that I saw that is like a not a lambda function.
Okay, yeah, so... Right, so, you don't have to create lambda functions in all of these cases. In all of these cases, you can actually define the function elsewhere and then pass it in the same way. Because A function is really just a fancy object, again, in JavaScript that you know, it's a that has a name, value pair, and all that stuff. But basically, when we refer to the function itself, we don't have to tell the jQuery the arguments that it accepts, because it assumes that it accepts one argument already. If we wanted, we could rewrite this lambda function here from the geocoder, this function right here, so make it a separate function, maybe function accept point, for example, and then have there one argument called point, and then have this same code, essentially. And then from there, I mean, it would be the same thing, but then all we would do here is have address and then comma accept point. And then
with
we would write with no parentheses, and that would also be acceptable. I assume that I can only make guesses as to why Chris decided to do it this way, but
I did it this way, because in this way you can call it also this function from other places. So if you want to populate the weather, you don't have to call it for the address
call. Certainly, yeah. So if you wanted to call this function from other places, that's a good way to do it. But also probably for legibility. I mean, you're putting in a lambda function and a lambda function, and it's getting really convoluted very quickly, and keeping track of all of these curly braces, it's just going to be a mess. So that's probably another good reason why he separated this callback function from, rather than having it be a lambda function. Yes?
Can we use jQuery in our project 3 if we want to?
I believe so. I believe you can use jQuery. There are no prohibitions if I want to.
Just about any time someone has asked if can we use some existing library, the answer has been yep.
Because I believe it's similar in spirit to using like YUI or something along those lines, so I don't see why not.
Does that function have to be called callback, or is that,
it does not
be a reference to it in the documentation?
It does not have to be called callback. You can call it whatever really long string you want. It could be anything, as long as it's consistent here, and also when you're passing the name of the function to jQuery, to the jQuery getJSON method. It should be consistent. This is probably just here for, I mean, it can get confusing if you're using the same terminology all of the time. You think that you have to use it, but you don't have to. You can rename most all of this stuff. Like map, we use we instantiate the gmap2 variable as map, but you can name it whatever you want, frankly. It doesn't have to be map. It's just an example. Any other questions? Okay, so don't forget that this code is available, not from Section 8, but this was Chris Power's example from last week. And if there are no more questions, then we'll quit a little bit early and see you all next week.